Welcome to Culture Matters, a podcast exploring the intersection of faith and culture. Hey friends, welcome back. So glad to have you, the OG crew today. It's me, Adam. Ty, how you doing?
Doing well, representing from Roanoke, Virginia.
Oh yeah. We miss you, dude. And Chels is here, too. Chels, how are you?
I just spilled coffee on my pants. So that's how I'm doing.
I'm sorry.
But they're black pants, and it's black coffee, so I feel okay.
It's not going to stain.
It's fine.
I'm usually always wearing coffee.
Somewhere.
Somewhere. It's on
my person.
I'm excited to talk to you guys today. I realize I say that on every show, but it's true. We're going to do some roundup. Some cultural roundup, which we haven't done in a while, and there's been so many big stories, just wanting us to consider from a Christian perspective, how do we respond to the headlines? And then second, we were going to do a little, like, I don't know, Oscars, some music, that
movies,
kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The roundup.
Yeah.
So let's dive right in. A couple top stories that I'd love to get. Maybe if one of you feel comfortable presenting it, but we have Iran and U.S., and then we have ongoing, I don't know, immigration, ICE unrest. It does seem like maybe the headlines have calmed down around it a little bit, but regardless, that's something that's been in the news a lot lately. So anybody want to set up either of those stories?
Pass. Sorry.
A few months ago, as it relates to Iran, a few months ago, Israel and the U.S. initiated strikes, largely airstrikes, against several targets in Iran, really trying to target infrastructure around their nuclear capabilities and then other military targets. Israel, I think, focused on leadership. So obviously you guys know, but their main leadership personnel have been targeted and killed. So Iran is kind of in a really precarious position, but now what they have done is retaliated with strikes, and they have blocked the Strait of Hormuz, which is the, I think 90% of oil from the Gulf comes through there, and it's caused oil prices to gas and gas prices to skyrocket. It's a lot. Some of the, you know, if at least from the U.S. side, some of the particulars, it seems to have split Republicans quite a bit. There was a side who said they voted for Trump because he promised no new wars. Now we have another war. So, yeah, not just for a right-left divide, but there's a divide even within Republicans around that. There was also, I think, in the very beginning, there was a missile, I think, from the U.S. I'm not quite sure, but I think it hit an elementary school or something like that. And it was really sad and obviously devastating. What else, guys? Is there anything else there that just from a fact, just here's the facts, anything else there that y'all have seen?
I mean, yeah, that's most of it. If I'm completely honest, I think aside from what you shared, I haven't known. I'll hear something and then somebody will say, well, that hasn't been confirmed. And some sources say it's confirmed, and then somebody say that it's not. And so there's, I don't know. I feel like that is almost a case on anything being absorbed from the news right now. But I'm like, the stuff that can't be, I mean, the stuff that I think found helpful in response to that have just been spaces that kind of, aside from whatever, you know, so the instance with the school being hit, it was like, was it, whose missile was it? Was it this? Was it? It's like, man, 150 kids lost their life. It's just heartbreaking. And I think I'm always interested in, like, are our hearts being bent in the right direction with some of this stuff versus trying to figure out the, I don't know.
Yeah.
Some of the nuances sometimes.
We're not geopolitical experts. So, you know, trying to pass judgment on it's I don't mean the school thing. I mean, just like on this conflict in general.
Totally.
It's really hard. You know, there's very interesting dynamics, and I don't know them all, but you have Iran has increasingly been a major player in the unrest in that region. They back Hezbollah. They back Hamas. They, it looks like, were helping sow discord over here by partnering with Venezuela and others. And so at least those are like the reports, right? And that's, or the justification offered. They back the Houthis in Yemen. So you have, you just have this destabilization in the Middle East, obviously. You have, you know, allies between China, Iran, and Russia. So there's this question of like, is this, was this a play to kind of, from the U.S. to kind of destabilize that, our adversaries, or however you, you know, however they put it. So there's a lot of different geopolitical things to consider there. And I'm just not an expert on it. What I'm trying to do as a Christian is kind of look and ask the question, how do we respond to this violence, the state of the world, you know, the things like you were saying, Ty. And I think the right way is to respond, you know, with a broken heart, you know, to pray, you know, to pray for the Lord's return. And so that's what I've been doing. But yeah, the other thing I'd say that's interesting is as I run into, you know, Persian Americans, there's a very interesting response. You know, there's heartbreak, there's concern for their families, and there's actually hope that the regime will be toppled. So again, it's just like, it's complex, you know? So yeah.
Yeah, I think that's my addendum or whatever would just be, I've heard mixed reviews, not from news sources, from actual people who are, they're hopeful for democracy to thrive. I mean, people who are from Iran or their families from Iran feel a certain way because it's been such a closed country for so long. But it's like, those things are so hard to, you're like, at what cost? To me, the thing I always come back to, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's the schools and stuff, but also just the turmoil. I mean, sure, yeah, it cost me $50 to fill up my small car yesterday. And those kinds of things, but also just like the loss of life. It's just unfathomable. And yeah, I think my prayer has been for peace. Like, I'm praying for things to work through. I mean, if you even go back further, the stuff in Venezuela happened. It's just, it's all very confusing. Yeah. Are those things connected? I've read mixed things about that. And motivations, you know, is it money? Is it political? Is it, it's whatever it is not godly. That's what I know.
And even if you view them as your enemy.
Yeah.
What does Christ tell us to do for our enemies? We love, pray for enemies. Them. We love them. Yeah. And so I think, if we're saying what's the citizens of America geopolitical, you know, our response to this conflict, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I know what the Christian response is, and that's to pray, to pray for peace, to pray that wars would cease to the ends of the earth, that swords would be beaten into plowshares, that the inbreaking of the kingdom would come, Jesus would return and put all of this, you know, put all of this right. And I think that's the proper response, the Christian, you know.
And to tease what you're saying out, because I know this is tucked in, that is part of that is like the Christian who is in the military right now, the Christian who works in, has a role in government in some way, the Christian who's in lawmaking, the Christian who's in policing or works in some sort of law enforcement, like maybe there is a like more unique feel. Like, I'd be curious to be, you know, I've talked with some folks on this side of the world that I know in those different realms, and like how they're processing that as a Christian. If maybe it looks different, maybe there's different pools as those convictions align with what they do. I think also part of it that I, when I'm thinking of like the Christian for us, who's like clergy, or the Christian who's a teacher, or the Christian who's a parent or part of a community in his work, it's like where it feels like your immediate motion is distance from like the expertise. And I think some of that, like what I've been trying to remind myself is whatever the thing going on, whatever the difficulty that lie ahead or where we find ourselves, whatever the response is, for sure what is true is we need to bring our best selves in trying to figure out those solutions and engaging mm-hmm. with one another. Nothing gets solved if our inward person and if our sentiments and our sensibilities are sour and bent towards, you know what I'm saying? And so it's like the work, part of the help is like the work of navigating, what does it look like helping members of our church and in our local body and in our community wrestle with these things, lament these things, talk with one another, disagree, still act charitably. It's like all of those muscles are needed to do whatever the work is in the various sphere you're in. And it's like, because there's a part of me that's like, man, I should I do more? And it's just like, honestly, I'm like, if you get me trying to do global political, whatever you said earlier, Adam, I'm like, man,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I'm out of depths. But I think if each of us are thinking about what we could be doing within our sphere and what our role looks like as a believer there,
yeah,
I think collectively, you know,
the thing that's hard,
overwhelmed.
Yeah, personally, I don't. I mean, maybe it's because I'm, to your point, Ty, my job. I don't find the Christian responsibility difficult to do the things we've been talking about. So I know some people do, and that's fine. The thing that's really hard is the civic responsibility. So as an American, you know, and I don't know where you're listening from, but if you live in a democracy, your job is to be well informed because ultimately you are responsible to elect representatives if you're in a representative democracy, which I am, that are making good decisions, right?
Yeah.
And that are better informed than us and stuff. I think what's hard, and we've addressed this so many times, but what's hard in our current state is how do you trust the information you're getting and where do you get it?
Totally.
So that responsibility to be a well-informed citizen as it relates to what's happening in Iran and why we're there, it feels like I either read propaganda or I read agenda.
Yeah.
And it's like, why did we do this? I don't know. One side hates Israel and is like, it's because we're, you know, they're anti-Semitic, honestly. I'll just be very honest. They're like, we hate Israel and, you know, we're just supporting Israel. That's what one side says. And the other side's like, Iran's evil and they're meddling in the, you know, the Monroe Doctrine. We've got to guard the hemisphere that we're, you know, it's America's responsibility. And it's like, I just don't know. It's really hard to know from a news perspective, like, what source do you trust? And so I don't want you to hear us kind of equivocate on like your responsibility as a citizen of whatever country you're in. It's just, I actually think in this day and age, what I can be sure of is not the information I'm getting, but what I can be sure of is who the Lord is and what he calls me to. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. No, thank you for saying that. I think for me, it was like with all the stuff, it's just honestly just overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It's just like there's such an anxiety around like I can't know enough or I can't. How do I discern all this? Like we're in 1 John and Bible class and sermons. Mm-hmm. We're spending a lot of time reading this. And John again and again is like discerning the spirit of truth and the spirit of lies. And, you know, anything that's against Christ is the Antichrist, obviously. But he's talking about a religious context. But it also is like, how do I just discern in general?
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been very hesitant to like make conscious choices, like to be like, oh, that's probably what that. I'm just like, oh, maybe,
yeah.
Which is probably a good way to approach it and have more questions than like critical statements. But also, it's just hard because it's like eventually I do want to be able to make a deciding voice. You know, I want to use my voice to vote and things like that. And it's like, how do I do that? How do I do it? I don't know.
It's hard.
So I'm overwhelmed. Yeah.
Yeah.
If I remember right, you love a slow morning, don't you?
I love a slow morning. I love being under blankets with a hot cup of coffee and a book.
Oh, yeah. You know, Cozy Earth is a sponsor. We've talked about them before.
Yes.
And I'm a big fan of, like, all of their stuff. The robe is so nice. I sent one to my mom. Did you send one to your mom?
I did.
She loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I got their jogger set and clogs. You need to get these for your friends and family because they're so wonderful. It feels like super soft material, comfy, but it's also like cute. The clogs too, they don't look like house slippers. Like they can be an everyday kind of casual wear. So on my slow mornings, which is my favorite, I'll just, you know, enjoy the coffee, enjoy the book. And then like I need to go run errands and I can just go in my jogger set.
That sounds amazing.
It's awesome.
This spring, give yourself the kind of comfort that lives with you all day. Head to CozyEarth.com and use the code CULTURE for an exclusive 20% off. And if you see a post-purchase survey, mention that you heard about Cozy Earth right here on Culture Matters. The second thing we brought up was ice. I don't know the latest, but I can paint with broad strokes. A few months ago now, which I'm not sure if we talked about on the show or not in detail, but ICE went into Minneapolis.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we addressed it a little bit.
Yeah. And you had Minneapolis, basically the local law enforcement there, as well as officials, kind of refused to cooperate. And so it set up this conflict almost between there's so many different ways you can paint it. What's been ongoing since then really is from a governmental perspective, a failure to fund the Department of Homeland Security because of what ICE is a part of. But that is affecting many other people and spheres. So like TSA lines and things like that, if you're a part of that. So the government, you have one side, the Democrats are saying, we're not going to fully fund whatever package you're putting forward as it relates to DHS. We will fund TSA and all these other things, but we're not going to fund ICE. And on the Republican side, they're saying you have to fund the whole thing. So there's this deadlock in what they're calling like kind of a quasi shutdown. So you have TSA agents who are working at the airport and not getting paid. Mm-hmm. You have that around DHS. So you kind of have this fight in the government right now around, you know, strategies for on the Democratic side, how they can not fund ICE, and on the Republican side, how they can fund and keep fulfilling what Republicans say was their promise to crack down on immigration and things like that. So it's a very personal thing for most people. It's scary to see masked people in the streets of America. Yeah. It's like, whoa, where are we? Like, we saw that like in the Eastern Bloc, and we saw that with like, you know, you also at the same time of that have a discovery of massive amounts of fraud, especially by certain immigrant populations. And we can just be honest about that. It's like there's fraud in all kinds of places, but it is true that there were certain folks taking advantage of certain government funding. For, you know, the one that kind of comes to mind is amongst the Somali population, I think, wherever that was in Minnesota or wherever it was, it looked like there was a daycare scheme or something. And then there's another one coming out right now. It looks like for certain hospice organizations in California that have been funded, and they've gone to like what looks like an apartment complex and there's empty offices everywhere. But there's billions of dollars being allocated to these hospice. I don't know exactly how it works. But what you're seeing is fraud and waste. The blame is being placed on immigrants in many cases. And so it's just it's a volatile time, you know. So I don't what I know to comment on and what we've told our church as clergy to comment on is we know what God tells us.
Yeah.
We know that our role when we see suffering is to pray, is to call out to God and ask him to come and come soon. Jesus, please return and fix all of this. And we know that we're called to be compassionate to people, you know, and to treat all people like they're image bearers. I don't believe personally that you can draw a straight line from the Bible to immigration policy. And I think if people can tell, if people tell you that, I think they're wrong. Frankly, it is absolutely true from the Bible that the government has a job, and part of that is a power of protection. And so there's, I think good Christians can disagree about a nation's immigration policy. And one can be more lax and one can be more strict. I don't think that Christians can disagree about how you treat the immigrant.
Yeah.
Meaning, if somebody come, you might have one country that says we're going to be very strict about immigration. And if you come here illegally, we're going to deport you, but we're going to treat you as a human being and with kindness, et cetera. Right. Mm-hmm. And you could have another person who argues, well, we need to do that differently and maybe whatever. I don't know. Because I don't know a lot about immigration policy. But my point is to say what everyone would say, though, is we're not going to treat them like they're inhuman.
Yeah.
Like they're the other. We're not going to hate them just because they're not whatever, Americans or whatever. We're not going to blame them for all the social ills. That's dangerous. Yeah. We know what that produces in history. We can look at that. So what I'm not doing on this show is giving you a prescription for what your country's immigration policy should look like or what America, I think Christians can disagree about that. What I am saying is let's just get back to scripture and see how we're to treat the sojourner and the foreigner amongst us with dignity and respect. They're made in the image of God. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And I think would be good for all of us is just not get caught up in the sides so much. Mm-hmm. We have very good friends whose families are scared and affected by what's going on.
Yeah.
I know people who see the immigration issues over the last few years as very real problems in America. And so you just, it's like trying to decide who's right and all that is difficult, but caring for and loving people, we always have that choice. Soapbox over. Push back. Tell me what y'all think.
I don't know about push back more than it's just, I think, doubling down on that idea. You know, part of when we talk about like civic duty and how our country is run and having a democracy, it's like, man, the strength of it isn't just in the decisions at the top. I think that's where like if our civic duty is solely about being able to make large sweeping changes at the highest levels, the most federal levels, that feels super overwhelming and not always, there's only so much you may be able to do from a sphere. But I'm like, if we think about on the basic levels of the makeup of institutions, which that's a whole nother conversation of just kind of the breakdown of multiple spaces within our communities. But it's like, man, it's actually in those spaces that we have the most ability to be engaged, involved, and enact change. And it's, I find so much, even in, especially in moments like this, of like whatever the response is, our obedience is always an act of faith. It's like I'm part of what I have to do to be effective where God has me and to play my role in whatever it is going on is I've got to operate here with what's in front of me and who's in front of me. And I get to trust that God, who's sovereign and more powerful than me, also has faithful men and women that he's using back in Plano, Texas, and in Minneapolis, and in California, and overseas. And it's like, I then get to operate in this space and say, what can I do to help my community? All those things you just talked about. Mm-hmm. How do I help my church, my community, my sphere of influence operate and flourish in this way? Because the reality is that the country is made up of a bunch of little communities. And we may, like I say, you may not be able to shift the whole, you know, continent, but it's like, man, you can, if you could help navigate conversations in the community around you to be able to talk about these things in a way where we're not othering one another, and we're able to listen to one another and see what's going on. It's like that is going to best poise. It's like when it does come times to do some of the, you know, the larger sweeping thing, a vote or, you know, getting something passed or whatever the case may be, we're all operating out of a different place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I'm reading this book we're talking offline by James K. Smith called Awaiting the King. And like, that's this whole thing of like thinking about our civic duty, not solely as, you know, us being thinking persons or even solely being like, all right, this is my opportunity to express my vote or to express my rights or to protect my rights. But if we are loving beings, part of our responsibility is like, how do we create and craft a culture that is forming our loves in a way that we as a community move more towards peace and shalom? And it's like that, it feels like we're too far out for that. Like, I feel like, man, that's too slow. And like, that feels like that won't change it all right now. And maybe it won't. Maybe it will. Part of, I think, our obedience being an act of faith is like, we have to be able to hold on to that, continue to do those things that we could be formed accordingly. And then when those opportunities to speak up, vote, get involved, do whatever, it's like, man, we're doing that out of a fullness and out of a rootedness and out of a conviction, out of scripture, and hopefully not just emotion, gut feeling,
the random
news that may or may not be, you know, rage baited.
Yeah.
And I feel like that so often is where the impulses are coming from.
Mm. Yeah, for sure.
Well, I mean, I think on that note, moving into books is a good like cue. So you're reading Awaiting the Kingdom. You know, just a final kind of note on that idea of if our goal is shalom, basically to live as ambassadors of the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm.
I think what that means is we should often confound people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I kind of want people to be a little frustrated by the positions I take, not because they're unclear, but because they're not easily put into a category.
Yeah.
Of
a worldly
Republican
category.
A worldly category of like Democrat or Republican or right or left or this philosophy, libertarian or this or whatever, but more just like, wait a minute, you know, on the one hand, you're arguing for this, and on the other hand, why would you do that? And it's like, oh, because my allegiance is the kingdom of God and Jesus spoke a certain way, and you're not going to easily put me in a worldly box, you know? And I feel like if what's happening is you can really easily put me in a worldly box, I'm speaking only for me, fellas and fellettes, but if you can easily put me in a box, I feel like I'm failing probably to live like I'm awaiting the kingdom, to use Jimmy Smith's words, you know? I don't know how you guys feel about that, but yeah, that's kind of, yeah.
So good.
No, I agree. I'm like, you look at Jesus, and it's he, for one reason or another, he, you know, caused tension in different spaces, and not because he was being a jerk to people.
No.
Like you said, right? It wasn't that. It wasn't because his views were unclear. His views were clear. He was gentleness, love, and patience. But it was also just not. It didn't fit perfectly in the worldly category, as you said. And I feel like that is that's something we got to embrace. And that is, I think that's one of the uniquenesses of, you know, what the Christian vision has to offer. Another text I've just recently read, it's an old book, Jesus and the Disinherited by Howard Thurman. It was like one of the books that inspired Dr. King before the bus boycotts. And his whole thing is just like how the gospel speaks hope and life to the poor and disenfranchised. And one of the things he talks about is like the he calls them the hounds of hell that harass those who are disinherited. One of them is hatred. And it's like, I thought this was probably one of the most profound things from the read, but he's like, there's a way in which when you feel as though you've been affronted, not even just feel as though, like you've been affronted, there's been some injustice or there's some impression or there's some, you know, power dynamic of some sort, that the temptation is to then hate those who are doing the wrong or hate those mm-hmm. who are on the other side.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, Jesus offers a way where we can acknowledge the wrong and we also don't have to hate in return. And he's like, mm-hmm. Jesus chose, he didn't hate in return, not because he didn't have the strength and he was getting overpowered, or not because, you know, he didn't understand, or not because he was like coalescing to what was going on. But it was like rather because he chose life, and he knew to hate in return was to choose death.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I found like that being another one of those like tool belts of like, man, there's something revolutionary and radical in the act of, hey, in the midst of all of the confusion and turmoil and hatred and polarization, man, I'm gonna be a presence that doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Where some, like, I think like badges of honor that I feel right now is like to be able to talk to somebody, whether they're a believer or not, no matter what their political views are, no matter where they stand and what, and we're able to have a conversation and they're able to be loved and cared for and feel like, man, like, I just feel like, you know, I've been walking around on eggshells and like when I'm at work and like in my family, like, but like mm-hmm. this just was such a, like a relieving conversation.
Mm.
Like, I feel like nothing's at stake. You're not running around. You're not trying to, you know, whatever. And it's like, man, I just feel like those moments count for more than maybe feels right now. And that's available to us
yeah.
in the gospel to meet people with that energy.
Name that book one more time.
Jesus and the Disinherited.
Mm.
Yeah, that's cool. I got to pick that up.
What about you, Chelsea? What are you reading?
I just finished. It probably took me a year. The Cross of Christ by John Stott. And I never read it. A lot of people in whatever Christian circle we're in like to quote him, but I never actually read any Stott. And so it was great. And I think it was funny timing just that we have Good Friday next week. And so it just, yeah, he goes through a lot of like what I like about it. He's a beautiful writer, which is unusual. Sometimes like preachers and speakers, their books are fine, you know, but he is a really great writer. And he just talks about why the cross matters and why, you know, why did Jesus even have to die? What does that mean? What does it mean when we say defeated sin and death? And kind of breaks through all those things, even like does some apologetic things like, oh, you might hear this argument. This is why I disagree and that kind of thing, which is, it was just really helpful from a theological standpoint. But it got me thinking a lot about like what you were just saying to Marcus about the book you're reading and the point of like, it's a radical way of living life that way. And I think the thing that I've been grateful for thinking of in reading this book, Stott's book, is the idea that like Jesus lived a life that was so radical that his death was also so radical, of course, spiritually, but even to the point of like his dying on the cross was so transformative that the guy who was dying on the cross next to him looked at him and said, surely that's the Son of God.
Mm.
Mm.
Like, I think that part of the story just for me stuck out, and I haven't fully like formed what that is, but it's just something about like, how do we give that kind of image to people who don't believe him, you know,
mm-hmm.
That like that Jesus didn't die for just his friends. Like he died for people who hate him,
mm-hmm.
like his death covers his enemies. You know, and so then they only need love him. Like that's all that is required. And so what does that look like to live that kind of life?
That's beautiful.
Yeah. So I just finished that book.
I love Stott.
I know. I'm like, I want to pick up more.
He's wonderful.
Yeah. It was good to do a slow read too. I kind of had to. It
was his biography, like who he was, is so fascinating. Yeah. Lived single his whole life.
Yes.
Just dedicated his life to being a pastor.
Yeah.
J.I. Packer modeled his life after Stott. So if you're a Packer fan, you should pick up Stott.
You should pick up some Stott. Yeah.
It's really great.
It was really great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I love that. I'm going to go
back. The book I just started was your suggestion. And I'm trying to remember the name of it, but it's like The Likeness of Christ or Form Like Christ. I've went and found it. It's a theology of change.
Oh, yeah. We got to try to get him on the show, but he's Australian. And, so it's like,
yes, it's an Australian author.
It's a biblical theology of change.
Yes.
And it's part of it's a commentary series.
Yeah.
Well, we'll put it in the show notes.
It's
wonderful.
I'm just completely blanking in this moment of time, of course, and I can't.
Formed into His Likeness is, I'm pretty sure, the name of the book.
I think that's it. Yeah. Formed into His Likeness, A Theology of Change. And I literally just started it yesterday, so I have gotten through the introduction. But I think it's going to be really good. I think it's like, the thing that sparked it for me was I've just been thinking, like, you know, a lot of the things I'm reading and stuff, it's like the connection of like the mind and body and soul, and how in the Bible it's phrased as like there's a renewal of your mind, but there's a lot of like psychology that is starting to catch up to how do you actually, like, you know, if you're anxious, how do you combat that? And it's like, you know, the secular psychology world would phrase it like repeat some positive thinking, but it's like positive thinking, if you apply it to a Christian mindset, you can actually apply Christian mindset and Christian thought and those things, and you do see change over time. So I'm fascinated at that.
Awesome. Two books I'm reading I'll do real quick is a Lenten study called The Word in the Wilderness. I think I've read it the last couple of years for Lent, and it's a poem a day for Lent and Easter by Malcolm Guite, who's just so great. So it's an anthology. Many of them are his poems, but he also pulls poems from others in there. And he writes a little, devotional is the wrong word, but he kind of like writes a little explanation on each poem. And it is deep and beautiful. And the poems are beautiful. And then the second thing I'm reading right now, and I've been in it for a while, is Martin Luther's biography. The one by Selderheis, I don't know how to say it.
How's your German?
But I became really interested. Martin Luther is a divisive figure, especially because late in his life, he was very ornery and wrote some rough things. But he so needed the grace and love of God. And discovered it through a relationship with Jesus by looking to God's word. And he suffered greatly. He was sick all the time. He was anxious. He had all these issues. And he tried to look to the church and found some allies in it. But for the most part, the church was offering something really strange and cheap that he couldn't, he couldn't find it when he went back to the source, to the Bible. And things like indulgences, you know, basically pay this amount of money. And it's like, where's God in any of that? And in order to kind of keep this system of like, you need to pay for your sins to keep that system going, it turned God into a really harsh judge. So it's like, God's a super harsh judge. Make sure you buy him off.
Very legalistic.
Very legalistic, but also kind of gross monetarily. Yeah. And if you actually looked at what was happening in Italy, you had these pilgrimages going there, and almost all the masses were about, how can we get your money off you? You know, they would sell you trinkets and all this kind of stuff. And literally, he was a rough dude. He often apologized for how polemic and strong he would be. So, you know, I'm not sure that most people would love to like sit down and have a conversation with him. Well, definitely not an argument with him, but he believed he needed God's mercy and grace so strongly, he was willing to die for it, for the truth. And I've just personally been incredibly encouraged by this guy who just was suffering daily with all kinds of ailments and found the only balm for his soul was a relationship with God and God's love for him and grace and mercy. And he's a remarkable dude. Yeah. And I think it's really great, by the way. I think Keller or Piper or somebody once said, you need to go, or somebody else, you need to go and find a previous theologian and just become their student, you know? And for me, that's been Keller mostly, but also, you know, Owen and some others, but I've liked adding Luther to that list. He's really wonderful. So I commend this biography to you. It's great. It's really, really great. So, yeah. Mm. All right. Let's quickly do Oscars very quickly.
Mm. Just to wrap it up.
I watched a little bit of, I saw who won. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It's weird, right? Like some people are like the Oscars and they get really down on it. But like what I do like about it is the fun of talking with your friends and being like, oh, they nominated that. What do you think's going to win? And so like my wife and I talk through it. You know, my friends and I will talk about it. And I like that. And I also like, oh, man, I haven't seen that yet. You know, those kind of things.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I am an unapologetic Oscar fan. It's fine. I don't care if you don't want to watch, and I don't care if you have strong opinions about, I mean, like, I get it.
Yeah.
I do think it's funny. There's always, you know, the Oscars every year kind of, they've broadened the category. So now it's like 8 or 10 options for Best Picture.
Yeah.
There's always the super indie ones that nobody saw. There's always the really like crowd pleasers.
Which are typically my
favorite. I know. And the crowd pleasers are the ones that like probably won't win.
Yeah.
And then the ones in the middle and whatever. And there's always like kind of a political one that you're like, I don't know. That was weird. Yeah. So anyway, for me, my two favorites, I'm not going to talk about what I didn't like.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay positive. My two favorites this year, favorite movies, were Hamnet and Sentimental Value.
Yeah, Hamnet, dude. What a movie.
What a movie. What a performance. So Jessie Buckley did win Best Actress.
Yep.
And it was incredible. I have to preface that one with any of my mother friends who have lost a child, don't see this movie. Because that's what it's about.
Yeah.
But if you can stomach that, it is the performance of the decade.
Yeah, it's
and
awesome.
And also I am a Shakespeare closeted Shakespeare nerd. I took Shakespeare in class I took a class in college on Shakespeare and studied his plays a little bit, and there's a lot of things they do in the movie from the it's based on a book too, so adapted from a book which is adapting from Shakespeare's life and the play Hamlet. And so there's so many like themes, the personification of death in these characters, the way the woods is a character in the film, is an interesting thing. There's like, it's William Shakespeare and his real factual wife. And she's called Agnes. But Anne Hathaway was her name. And Agnes is like very ethereal and like earthly and loves to be outside and like a gardener, and she's like teaching her kids all these like, you know, things. She's always dressed in red in the movie, which symbolizes, I think, the warmth of her character. And then William Shakespeare's always dressed in blue, this kind of like sort of cold. He's a thinker, he's a little bit of an alcoholic, and he wants to be in the city and he wants to write plays and he wants to be famous and he wants to be known as a writer and be this great writer. Kind of struggles with like his fatherhood aspect. And she's just so motherly. And she's like, you're leaving. And then there, you know, a child dies. It's just, there's drama, obviously. But it's just really beautiful. And I think it makes you think about grief in a way. And it's like, the thing I think is great about it. So the whole final scene is her watching Hamlet, the play, which is based on her son who she's lost.
Mm.
And so she's like real time reacting to scenes and realizing that it's like she gets. To me, it's the most powerful scene because it's the way that art can like, can just create this connection to you and even to like things that you've lost. So even the way that I think about the people I've lost in my life that we shared the love of a book or a movie.
Yeah.
And that movie always makes me think of them. Does
yeah.
that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, or that book or that song or that yeah. album. So like the way that art can cross time and can it's cross awesome. Culture and can cross life and death, which mm-hmm. is just, it's just fascinating.
Yeah.
And even, you know, scripturally, it's like, there's all types of scripture. There's narrative scripture, there's poetic scripture. Mm. And so the fact that we can read the Psalms and we understand the feelings, you know, mm-hmm. so even like that, I think there is something godly and spiritual and special about the way art does that.
Yeah.
And so I just loved that movie. And then just a side note, Sentimental Value.
Yeah.
Is so good.
Yeah.
It's a Norwegian,
it's a very Norwegian film, dude.
It's very Norwegian. Yeah. But it also is like this interesting family dynamic and like a father and his daughter's trying to reconcile a right. little bit after their mother has died. And it was just really beautiful. Yeah. I was very moved at that movie. And so those were my two favorites.
What about you, Ty? Anything there?
I have not seen most of the movies that were nominated for
I know
Oscar,
which one you saw, though.
But I did see one of them.
Yeah.
And I will just say, I am a huge Michael B. Jordan fan.
Oh, yeah, man.
I
was so happy you won.
Station, Black Panther.
Yeah.
Creeds, like, all this all across the board. And he crushed that role. There was a number of things. I mean, the movie itself is a thing.
He plays two roles, so
for the listeners, you're talking about Sinners.
Yeah.
He plays twins, so he plays two different characters, and they're very different characters. Mm. Yeah.
They're very different characters. I learned a lot post the movie that made me appreciate it even more.
Yeah. Cinematographer was also.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the cinematography, the music, the score, like, there's a lot of elements. Like I said, it's also a lot to the movie. It's I am not a fan at all of horror movies.
Yeah, same.
So I will say that. I know some who are scared of elements of this movie. I think the story is so interesting and well executed that like there's this market moment. I've seen it multiple times with different people. And there's this market moment where it's like, I can kind of tell they're like, oh, wait, oh, I didn't want to get into this. And then something happens and you're like, oh, wait, I see what's happening. Mm-hmm. And it just like shifts the way you see everything that's going on, which is really, really, really interesting. But particularly the way Michael B. Jordan was able to distinguish the two brothers, they're like to the point. I noticed there was one character when he was that brother. He always would smile. He was a little more jovial. The other brother was pretty, you know,
stoic.
Stoic, you know. Yeah. That one wore blue. The more jovial one wore red. But he held his face in a way when he was one of the brothers, so that his cheeks had dimples.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was the other brother, they went away. That is, how do you even do that?
Yeah, I saw him on an interview and he talked about like he had like a phrase. I don't know what the phrase was, but he had a phrase that would get him into character and get the voice because the voices are different, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that kind of thing is fascinating to
me.
I love that kind of nerdy acting stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, the performance was great. Obviously, the movie's not for everybody. It's fine.
Plug for Paul Thomas Anderson. He's probably my favorite living director. He might be like, let's just put him in the top three. there are certain directors where when you watch a film, you know it's their film, right?
Yeah.
Wes Anderson's one of those. Paul Thomas Anderson's one of those. Magnolia, Punch Drunk Love, There Will Be Blood, on and on. It's interesting because One Battle After Another, which one? Including Best Picture, Best Script, Best Director. I don't think it's his best movie.
I was going to say.
Which is interesting.
It was frustrating for me because it felt like they just had to give him an award, and I get it.
Yeah.
Because he is, but it was not his best movie.
I'm a Thomas Pynchon fan as well, who is a very kind of like postmodern writer. Like if you... He wrote Gravity's Rainbow. He's written a lot of like very difficult to read books, frankly.
Yeah.
And this movie is based on one of his books. Here's what I'll say. Leonardo DiCaprio's performance in it is crazy. I mean, it's one of Leo's best performances. And so I think it's worth, if you like watching a good performance, I think it's worth it to see Leo. Sean Penn also did a great job in it. But it's a long and strange movie. So I, just to be honest,
if
you've got 2.5-3 hours to spend, then have at it. But yeah, it was interesting that he won for that one. I mean, I would commend like a Magnolia or a Punch Drunk Love to you first, or There Will Be Blood is like one of Daniel Day-Lewis's best performances of all time. So, you know,
when award shows do that,
he's an interesting guy. He makes interesting movies. So I'm glad he won on one level, but on another level, yeah, it was, I think there were probably better movies this year. So
yeah,
interesting. That's really it for me for Oscars. But the last one, you just have a little note in there.
Oh, I forgot.
That Project Hail Mary came out.
Oh, hey. Did you see, Tamarcus, have you seen it? Project Hail Mary?
No.
Oh, bro, you got to go see it.
Listen, everybody right now.
To be fair, I haven't been to the movies.
I know.
In a hot
Hear me out. You let Chrissy have a day. I don't know. You just need to go. Take a friend. Okay. Go by yourself. Biggest screen you can find. I don't know what that is in Roanoke. But it is. It's so good.
Yeah.
I joined the Hawkins family last weekend. Yeah. It was so good.
It was. And I was able to bring my kids who span in ages from 12 to 8. And so, like,
yeah,
I don't even think there's language in it.
It honestly is. I was thinking that in the middle of it. I've seen it multiple times. We don't need to talk about it. I thought that the second time I saw it, and I was like, this is actually like one of the most family friendly movies in a while that is not like a kid movie.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's PG-13 because it's like it's in space
peril.
And
yeah.
There's like danger and stuff
danger,
like that.
Space yeah. peril. The world is ending. That's kind of scary. Yeah. So like little kids are, and also the science side, little kids are not going to understand. But
remember like when Ted Lasso came out and everybody was like, wow, that was the show that the world needed at that time because it was like positive and it had like redeeming qualities. It almost feels like Hail Mary is 2026 is Ted Lasso. It's like,
well, what it is like the world is ending, but hey, we're going to figure this out together.
Yes.
And
it's a buddy movie.
And yeah, and we're going to work together and collaborate and like
it's
friendship. It's about friendship. And it was really fun.
It's literally a movie about friendship set in space.
100%.
And it's so great.
Yeah.
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 Who wouldn't want friends in space?
Dude.
I would not want to be in space alone, for sure. There is one thing that, because I read the book, and there's one thing that they don't really clarify in the movie is that Rocky was alone for 40 years, which, you know, spoiler alert, it's not a spoiler because they put it in the trailer that there is other life out there, quote unquote. But I think they live multiple centuries. Like, their life spans longer than humans. So 40 years to him is not a long time, but that is a long time, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so that
great film.
It's great.
Highly commended to you and yours. Awesome, guys. Well, you know, we talked about, man, we spanned a lot. We covered a lot today. And maybe end just with an encouragement to say the world can feel out of control and crazy. God has a plan. And we always have the choice. To move towards him, to choose kindness, love, to friendship, to live in his world, in his way. And it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
But in the midst of difficulty, we can get so caught up in how do we solve this problem? How do we do that? And we lose sight of God simply called us to be faithful. And so, that doesn't mean he hasn't called us to cultivate. That doesn't mean hasn't called us to try to bring shalom and peace to the world. But very often that's not through policy decisions that are made on, you know, in the White House. Those are through day-to-day interactions between you and the Lord and between you and those that you have, you know, that you have a responsibility to or influence on. So,
This episode is produced by Chelsea Conway with editing and support from The Good Podcast Company. As always, check the show notes for resources and ways to connect with us and our guests. Thanks for listening.